ברוכים הבאים רבותיי, ותשכו לשנים רבות, נעימות וטובות. We're starting tonight parashat ki tetzeh l'melchama. By no means is tonight's parasha an easy one. It goes down as the most difficult parashiyot, without a doubt. The beginning of it especially, there comes a time where you have to finally try to give an interpretation to a very mysterious chapter. The Torah is telling us about Jewish people that go out to war, soldiers, and they take captives. And in the captivity, there's Eshet Yifat Tuar. Really interpreted to mean a lady that's pretty. The Hashaktaba. And the soldier's going to have a certain lust, certain desire for her. The Torah says, take her, bring her to the house, let her shave her hair bald, let her grow her nails, let her change her clothes, let her sit for 30 days, then she can convert, and then you can be with her, and take her as a wife. And if you don't want her after 30 days, then of course you can send her free. Now, the reason why this is so difficult, who are we talking about over here, Rabotai? Jewish soldiers. Should I remind you who used to fight in the wars? The cream of the crop of our people. Last week we studied that there were many exemptions. People that did not have to fight. One of those exemptions were a person or people that are not religious. It doesn't mean religious that the Mechalel Shabbat. It says, even if a person has a minor sin, such as he talks between the Tefillin Shel Yad and the Tefillin Shel Rosh, he cannot control himself. One time he said hello to his friend when he was putting on the Tefillin. It's a mistake. This guy's exempt from the war. Because it's a flaw in his religiosity. It's a flaw in his fear of God. Therefore we're scared that he might die in the war. So who used to go out to war? People that had an impeccable record in religion. The most devout Jews. You're talking about Chachamim. The Tzaddikim used to fight with beards down to the floor, with big hats and long coats. The Jewish army in the olden days looked very different than any army ever looked. The last people you'd think that went out to fight, those were the ones that went out to fight. The ones that you would think are least capable to fight a war, those were the ones that went out to fight the war. It was a battle with the greatest of our people. That's why it's hard for me to understand. Why, this guy sees a G in the war, and all of a sudden he can't control himself. I mean, you're not talking about soldiers in Saddam Hussein bin Laden's army over here. You're talking about great Hachamim. Well, all of a sudden they go to the war, they see a lady, they can't control themselves, they bring her, control yourself. What do you mean? You bring her back. And then what does it mean when it says in the Pasuk that she has to wait for 30 days? What's that all about? Why does she have to make herself ugly? What is the mitzvah to make herself ugly? It says she has to let her nails grow long, she has to shave her hair, for what purpose? And then it says that after she makes herself look ugly, if you don't want her after that, then already you let her go. Well, you think anybody's going to want her after that? She looks like Gehinnom after those 30 days. The wicked witch of the West. All of a sudden now you're going to want to take her? Who in their right mind is going to want to take her? In the war, she looked pretty. So therefore you had desire for her. So 30 days, you put her through the mill. Now you say, if you still want her, okay, who's going to want her? What kind of system is this over here? Well, whether I'm allowed to say this or not tonight, because we're going to talk a little Kabbalah, but I think it's, whether it's understood or not, also is going to be questioned, because I certainly don't understand it to its fullest depth, but the Ora Chaim HaKadosh discusses these dilemmas. So my advice, first of all, for good reading, you must read the Ora Chaim HaKadosh on his understanding of this whole parasha. I'll just give it to you in brief what he says. He writes like this. Adam Rishon, when he committed that sin in Gan Eden by eating from the tree, you can't imagine the devastation that that sin brought to the world. Not only to the physical world, but to the spiritual world. You see, Adam Arishon's neshama was massive. It was very, very big. It encompassed all the neshamot of anybody that will ever live. All the tzaddikim, all the Jews, they were all included into his neshama. When they say he was the father of all mankind, it means literally, not only with the genes, meaning his neshama was the universal neshama. And then when he sinned, there was like an explosion in his neshama. All the sparks of his soul now started to scatter. It was devastating. And they call it the Sitra Achara, which is the other side, meaning the bad side, the dark side. You want to call that the Satan, the Yetzer Hara, all the gangsters. They came along and they took a lot of those sparks. And it's the job of Jews in this world to try to recover those sparks, to bring them back to our side. And once all the sparks are recovered, so we have all our players back on our side, then Mashiach can come and we made the final tikkun. Now, sometimes those sparks, those souls that were taken into captivity by that side, they're sent down into Goyim. If a Goy has one of those souls, rest assured that Goy will convert. All converts have in them Jewish souls. And that's why they convert. It's the soul that inspires them to become Jewish. To the extent that Arizal writes that there's a saying that goes that every convert, when he's taken to heaven after 120 years, one of the questions that they ask him is, what took you so long? What do you mean, what took me so long? I converted when I wanted to convert. I had learned how to do. But the basis of the question is, you had it in you. So what took you so long to let your pure soul overtake your physical instincts? You should have let it happen earlier. Ruth is a perfect example. Ruth, who was a convert, obviously she possessed one of these holy souls, and it finally overtook her and she came around. But ask yourself a question. When she married her husband Mahlon, she wasn't Jewish. After her husband died, she converted. And then she went and married Boaz. Boaz was the relative that she fulfilled the mitzvah of Yibum. Now, why was she obligated to marry Boaz? Well, as a result, that was a relative of her husband. That's the Jewish law. But what do you mean? When she married her husband, she wasn't even Jewish. The marriage wasn't even a marriage. The only time we have a mitzvah of Yibum is when a Jew married a Jew, and then one of them died, now the lady marries the brother or the relative. But it wasn't a marriage to start off with. When she married Mahlon, she wasn't Jewish, so all these connections don't start. So what does Ruth have to go with Boaz for? What are they trying to connect them? But the explanation is that when Ruth finally converts, it becomes clear to us retroactively that her soul was a Jewish soul. It just took time to overtake her. And therefore, when she was married to Mahlon, in truth, there was a Jewish soul married over here to a Jewish man. Therefore, all bets are still on. So it's as if there was something Jewish over there. Because her soul was Jewish. It just took time to surface. Now watch. Unfortunately, we don't have the vision when we're walking down the street and we see a goy to say, oh, he's got a soul of a Jew. we can't even project who's going to convert and who's not going to convert. But the Or HaHaim HaKadosh says that some people have that power. He says, when you're doing a mitzvah, when you're involved in a mitzvah, the light of the Shekhinah rests upon a person, and it gives the person almost prophecy. It gives a person a certain vision and a certain level that he cannot attain if he was not doing the mitzvah. So he says like this. These soldiers are the greatest rabbis, as we proved. And what are they doing? They're fighting a war. What type of war? A war that's considered milhemet mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to fight this war. So in the middle of the war, in the zechut of the mitzvah that they're fighting, and the level of the people that are fighting, all of a sudden they see a lady. What do they see in this lady? They're attracted. You know why they're attracted, he says? Not because of their beauty. They're able to evaluate that is a lost soul. It's like Raiders of the Lost Ark. This is Raiders of the Lost Soul. They're able to understand that there's a soul over there that needs to be brought to our side. And the Pasuk says, by the way, Veshavita Shivyo, and you will take the captive into captivity. May I ask you a question? What does it mean, Veshavita Shivyo? You'll take the captive into captivity. She's not a captive until you take her. It should say, Veshavita Ota, and you'll take her into captivity. You can't take a captive into captivity. She's not a captive till you take her. The explanation is that lady is a captive. Not physical, but her soul is a captive inside of her. And therefore you have to bring that soul that's in captivity, you have to bring it out to our side. You're redeeming the soul over here. Veshavita Shivyo. You have to save the captive from captivity. That's the soul that's inside of her. And the Pasuk writes, Veshakta ba. It says, and you'll have a desire for her. It doesn't say v'hashakta ota. What does ota mean? Ota means her. What does ba mean? Ba means what's inside of her. V'hashakta, where is your true desire? Not ota. V'hashakta ba. The desire is what's inside of what you, this desire over here of the souls. Now, of course, don't try this at home. This is a dangerous concept. You'll have some pervert walking around the street and say, oh, gee, over here's got a neshama, over there I have to make an exorcist over here. This is not for our level, obviously. And of course, you have gangsters out there that will distort anything. But we're talking on the high level tonight. So the Torah says, I want you to point out that if you remember the story, you remember when Dinah, the daughter of Yaakov, she was raped by a fellow called Shechem ben Hamor. And you remember Yaakov Abinu's reaction. Yaakov's reaction was not a militant reaction. He was calm about it. His children went crazy. Shimon and Levi started screaming. They made a war. But Yaakov was very, very poised. The Zohar writes that Shechem ben Hamor, he had one of those neshamot, holy neshamot. Actually, he had the neshamot of a rabbi that was destined to live later on in history, the neshamah of a rabbi called Rav Hananya ben Teredyon. They even learned it from the Pesukim. It says over there, when Shechem ben Hamor invited Yaakov and his family to live in Shechem, they tell Yaakov that the land is Rahavat Yadayim. The land is very, very wide, very bountiful, very beautiful. The word Rahavat, the Zohar writes, is Otiyot Rav Hananya ben Teredyon. Rahavat. to indicate that Shechem had a holy soul in him. And that soul needed to be bringing to our side. Shechem didn't convert. So we had to redeem it. So look what God does. When Shechem took Dinah, even though it was by force, Dinah's a tzaddiket. The soul of Hananiah bin Teradion jumped ship. It jumped from Shechem to Dinah. And therefore, a soul was redeemed. And that's why Yaakov Avinu doesn't react. He understands that this had to happen. This is something in God's master plan to save a neshama that was on the wrong side. And that's why if you look at the Pesukim over there, when Shechem is with Dinah, the Pasuk writes, Vatidbak nafsho bedinah. What does it mean? And his soul became attached with Dinah. Oh, amazing. Now that's a funny way of saying if a person's raping a lady, you don't say his soul became attached to it. What soul? It's not a spiritual story over here. This is a physical disaster. But the Pasuk is writing you what really happened. But Tidbak Nafsho, his soul became attached to Dinah. That's the way it works. There's more to say on the story of Dinah, but we'll stop short over here to go back to our story. So you have a soldier that's in the war. He's in the middle of a mitzvah. He has an attraction to this lady. She doesn't necessarily have to be beautiful at all because he's not even looking at her beauty. He sees that there's a soul over here that he's connected to. You see, because everybody, when you get married, English, they call it soulmates, but we believe in that concept, which means the soul of a man is not complete until he finds his nasib. And the soul of the wife completes his soul. So therefore, you're going to have an attraction. There's an attraction going to be there. It's a physical, but it's also a spiritual attraction. So when this guy's in the war, his soul is connecting to that lady because it's his other half. So what does the Torah say? Just to make sure that it's real feelings, bring her to the house before you do anything. Make her ugly. Now, after she's ugly, like you can't imagine, 30 days later, if you still have a desire for her, that's an indication that the feelings are not physical. In the beginning, you can second guess. Yeah, maybe it's spiritual, maybe it's physical. But after she looks like what she looks like, and you ask the guy, you still want? And she looks like, forget it. I want. What do you want? This is what you want? So that shows you that it's a pure intent. So that's what the Torah makes you go through this process. Now watch. In the beginning, the Torah uses the word, the hashaktaba. The word hashakta means you desire, meaning could be it's coming from lust. We don't know yet. But after 30 days, the Torah writes, Behaya im lo hafatztaba. The word hafatzta also means to desire, to want, but it's not out of lust anymore. The word hafatzta is used, meaning it's rational. When a person desires something because of lust, we use the word lachshok. When a person desires something because it makes sense, we use the word lachpotz. In the beginning, we don't know, it could be desire, so the Torah uses v'hashaktaba. But after 30 days, after she looks ugly, now the Torah says, v'hayayim lo hafatztaba, it's not physical anymore. If you don't have a desire for the Torah, says v'shillachta l'nafsha. Look at the Torah right here. Doesn't say send her away. It says send her soul away. V'shillachta l'nafsha. What is the word l'nafsha doing over here? Eilat's coming to tell me that after 30 days, if you have no attraction, that means it wasn't, the soul that she has is not going to turn, jump ship to our side. Get rid of her. Send her soul away. There's no hope for this one. Now, this is a great indication how deep our Torah is. Because I want you to know, David HaMelech took a Yifat Torah, by the way. David HaMelech was in a war, and he saw one of these ladies, and he brought her back, and he went through the whole process, and he married her. Now, none of us over here are going to accuse David HaMelech for going after physical desires. I mean, David HaMelech is a Hasid, he's a holy man. he was devoid from any evil. David HaMelech is the chosen one from God. Torah writes, "Hashem Imo," God is with him. So therefore, based on this interpretation of the Ruach HaKadosh, on the contrary, David HaMelech was able to see through this lady, see the neshama, it was all spiritual. This has nothing to do with the physical story. To show you how you have to learn the Torah in its true depth. You can read this story and get a very distorted version of exactly what the Torah is coming to propose. But you see, based on the Zohar, there's a lot of depth. Now, I'm not saying that every soldier had this Kavanah. Some soldiers probably went and took the lady according to the simple explanation. But the real tzaddikim that fulfilled this mitzvah, they had what we said in mind. We go to the next story. Just as difficult. Perasha progressively gets harder. The story of the Ben Sorer Umore, the rebellious son. You have a boy that's about 13 years old. Torah tells us he stole some money from his mother's pocketbook. He went out, he ate some meat. He went to the bar, he drank some wine. His parents grab him, take him to Beit Din. They say, "Our son is a glutton. He's rebellious. He's a rebel." And Beit Din takes the kid and kills him. It's wild. I mean, if we would start killing the youth just because they took a drink, so that's it. You wouldn't have any kids, God forbid. So what does this mean over here, this Torah law of a Ben Sorer Umore? How do we explain it? It's complicated, furthermore, that the Gemara writes it never happened. This case never happened. They never killed, they never stoned a rebellious son. So what does Torah write it for? So the Gemara says, Drosh v'kabil sachar. Gemara says it's one of those laws where you just get credit for learning it, and even though it never happened. I need credit for learning it. There's not enough Torah that I can get credit for learning. The Torah, Baruch Hashem, is very vast that if I'm looking for credit, I can open up 150 books if I wanted credit. Torah says, you know what? This is a bonus perasha. Read the Pesukim, learn the Gemara, and you get credit even though it never happened. How do you explain that? So I heard from the rabbis that they say, even though it never happened, but there is a lesson. The reward that the rabbis tell you by learning this perasha is the reward of parenting. If you learn this perasha good, you learn exactly some very important insights of what it means to be a good parent. Number one, the pasuk writes that they go to the Beit Din with this kid. They grab him. They bring him to the Beit Din and they say, "Benenu ze soreru more enenu shomeya bekolenu." He doesn't listen to our voice. So parents are trying to say, we told him, we said to him stop, we rebuked him. He doesn't listen to us. So Rabbi Giftis says, Alav Shalom, the word kolenu means voice. But the more proper word to be used here is not kolenu. It should be enenu shomeya lidvarenu, to our words. Because there's a difference between devarenu and kolenu. Devarenu is when somebody gives you an instruction that you understand. A divur is a clear direction. Kolenu is a voice. It's a direction where, it's an instruction where you don't really understand. It's a call. It's noise. Why would the parents come along and say, he didn't listen to our voice. You say, he didn't listen to our dibur, to our words. So Rabbi Giftis says, because we're talking about a child, that when it was rebuked by his parents, the child's reaction was, what are you talking about? You're from Mars. To the child, the parents' rebuke was kolenu. It was noise, it was voice. And that's what the parents are coming to tell Beit Din. We rebuked them, we told them you shouldn't drink. Don't go to the club. Don't go to the bar. Don't take the money, it's a bad habit. and the child's looking at the parent, where are you from? What generation do you come from? This is backwards, this is behind the times. Enenu shomeya bekolenu. Not only did we rebuke him, but not only didn't he understand us, but he thought we were crazy. To the child, it was kolenu. And unfortunately, while parents should try to speak clearly to their children, that their children understand them, but many times the parent can be very clear and the message can be 100% valid, but the child, for some reason, until he matures, never trusts the parent's judgment. To a child, the parent is always old-fashioned. Therefore, the child always thinks the parent is wrong. And therefore, no matter what the parent says, 1 + 1 = 2, it's kolenu. What are you talking about? The Torah is telling the child, you have to listen even when you don't understand. Because the parents know best. The parents have experience. The parents have wisdom. The parents have age. The parent knows what's for the best for the child. So even if it's kolenu, even if it sounds like noise to you, there was once a statement once said, when a child by a fellow, he said, when I was 18 years old, I thought my parents had no wisdom. They were backwards, they were old-fashioned, they were not up to beat. And then when I got to the age of 23, I realized that my parents were smart, they were progressive, they were great advice they gave me. It's amazing how much they learned and matured in 5 years. His parents matured in 5 years. They changed. He changed. So you see over here, the first lesson is to the children, really. That even if it sounds like kolenu, they should listen. Subjugate yourself to your parents, even when it doesn't make sense to you. Because the parents ultimately know best, and they want the best for their children. The second lesson is, Torah writes, Enenu shomeya bekol aviv uvkol imo. They come along and say, our son, he does not listen to the voice of his father and to the voice of his mother. So the Gemara learned something here. That's probably why Ben Soren over there never happened. The Gemara says, kol aviv vekol imo, that the mother's voice and the father's voice have to be the same. For a ben sorer or moreh to happen, the mother and the father have to have the same voice. Somebody said, when are you going to have a case where you have parents that have the same voice? Was a lady ever sound like a man? Man sounds like a lady? And even if they do, they have to be married to each other. It's never going to happen. So the Gemara puts a condition here that for all practical purposes, we'll never make this case happen. But the rabbis learn a lesson. They say when the Gemara says that the father's voice and the mother's voice have to be equal, it means the message that they're giving their children. Doesn't mean the pitch. Doesn't mean the sound. Kolan Shavin means that parents cannot give mixed messages to their children. Because if a parent gives a mixed message, the child becomes schizophrenic. The child becomes like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He becomes confused. How many times do you see it where the father's religious and the mother's not religious, or the opposite case? The father tells the boy before he goes to work, make sure you go to shul, make sure you pray, make sure you learn, make sure you put on your tzitzit. The father goes to work, the mother tells the child, don't worry about it, I won't tell daddy. The different head now. So the child becomes confused, or the opposite. Therefore, it's very important that there's consistency in the parents. It's the same message. That the parents have to go into the room alone and come out with the proper philosophy that they want to teach, and that's it. When a child sees inconsistency, so there's room for him to sneak out. If he doesn't like what his father says, he'll find compassion from his mother. If his mother, he'll go to his father. He plays them, divide and conquer. The Torah is telling you over here, Bekol aviv u'bekol imo. in parenting, it has to be a unified message in order that the child becomes properly mechonach, properly educated. But there's a third lesson here. It says, when they take their son to the Beit Din, they turn to the rabbis of the Beit Din and they say, Benenu Zeh, this boy, they point him, Zeh. The Gemara learns a condition. From here we see that to make a ben sorer or more, the parents cannot be blind, God forbid. Because if they're blind, they can't say, this boy, because they can't see him. When you say this, you're pointing him, this boy. But if they're blind, they can't say this boy. So here you learn a law. The rabbis explain what's the depth behind this law, that the parents can't be blind. So the explanation is like this. God forbid if a parent is blind, the parent cannot see the individuality of his child. And therefore gives the child the chinuch that's standardized. That's the normal textbook chinuch. He's not able to discover the child. So therefore the Torah says if the parent is blind, you can't hold the kid responsible. Because he didn't receive the proper chinuch. He didn't receive that tailor-made chinuch that he's supposed to have. It was a standard textbook chinuch that everybody gets. It was a cookie cutter chinuch, which we don't believe in. The Torah says that every single child must deserve the vision of the parents. The parent must discover the child and give the child exactly what it needs. And no two children are the same, just like no two snowflakes are the same. And therefore what's expected from child A is not expected from child B. And the same to child C. Each child is a separate entity and you have to create a program of chinuch accordingly. Therefore you have to see your children. You have to know them intimately. You have to get to understand them. And therefore establish a chinuch pattern for each one. A custom-made pattern. That's the third lesson. Let's review quickly. Lesson number one, Bekolenu. That even if it sounds like noise, the child still must obey the parents, even though he doesn't understand. Number two, it must be called Abi Vekol Immo. It must be a unified message. Number three, they must be able to point to the child and say, Benenu Zeh. They must see their children. They must know each child. Number four, these parents, even though they have a ben sorer and moreh on their hands, you have to give them credit for being good parents. Why? Look at their reaction. How many parents would take such a drastic reaction? Do you see a 13-year-old, so he's eating some meat. So he likes to drink wine. Are you going to call the cops on the kid? You say, okay, he'll grow up. Hazid, he's a kid, leave him alone. We used to do that when we were kids. Let him have a good time. Leave him alone. Not going to be so strict on him. Hazid. These parents are really amazing. The kid's 13 years old. He didn't do anything yet. He's just on the road to become an addict. He's on the road to become addicted to the good life. He's on the road, the Gemara says, to become a murderer. Because if he gets addicted to this good food and to this good wine, one day he's not going to have money in his pocket. And he's going to mug somebody. And his victim is going to resist. And he's going to want that money because he has to have that wine. So he'll kill him. So the Gemara is saying, be careful. You see that when he's 13 years old. No, when he's 30, he's going to be sitting in jail because of it. And whose fault was it? It was the parents that had an attitude when the kid was 13. He's only a kid. Don't worry about it. What's going to come out? Leave him alone. Nothing's going to happen. A parent must not shirk his responsibility. Even at a young age, a parent can never discount and say, he's only a kid. Leave him alone. When he gets old, I'll teach him. When he gets old, it's too late. Therefore, the Torah is telling you, look at what good, responsible parents did to their child. They came to Beit Din, they grabbed the kid. Beit Din handled him, he's out of line. Beit Din said, what did he do? Did he kill anybody? No, he didn't kill anybody. Tell us what he did. Did he damage anybody? He didn't damage anybody. What did he do? He drank wine. What are you flipping out? He drank wine. So, what's the big deal over here? No. What do you mean? If we don't stop this now, where's it going to lead to? And you know what Beit Din tells the parents? You're 1,000% right. They take the kid, they throw him off a building for this. They stone him. So although it never happened, it's all theoretical, but the lesson to the parent is strong. That this is the proper reaction that you have for your children. It's not considered overreacting. It's not considered overparenting. It's not considered being overzealous. Especially in the society that we live in today, that there's so much attraction to the pleasures of this world. And unfortunately, many parents are unsuccessful in insulating their children from it. So today you cannot be accused for overparenting. On the contrary, one has to be very, very extra cautious to see any signs when the child is young of swaying off that path, to make sure that they're put back in line. Beninu zeh sorer moreh. There's a praise to parents that were, in this case, overprotective in order to save their child. The last law that we'll discuss tonight is the law of Kansipur. Person's walking on the road, he sees a bird's nest. Torah says, take the mother and shoo it away, take the chickens or take the eggs. And if you do this, God promises you the world. You'll be blessed like nobody was ever blessed. You'll find the house. God will bless you with a beautiful garden. God will bless you with beautiful clothes, a beautiful family, parnasa. What's the big deal? You're dealing with a mitzvah that takes 3 seconds to do, and there was no planning even. It's not like building a sukkah, it takes you a week to do, and you got to sit in it, sleep in it. Hey, you're walking on the road. The Torah writes, ki yekare kansipur. It just happened. It's random. It can't even be in your backyard. If it's on your private property, you can't fulfill the mitzvah. It's got to be on the road. You're walking one day, says, huh? Here's a nest. Oh, you climb on the ladder, you handle it, forget it. You hit lotto. The question is, what's so big about this mitzvah here? So I heard an explanation as follows. The key word in this parasha is ki yikare. This mitzvah can only be done by chance, which means it wasn't prepared, it just happened. Ki yikare, it's mikre. It was a random event. You just walked down the street, it popped up in front of you. There's another time in this week's parasha where this word is used. At the end of the parasha, we learn about Amalek. Remember when Amalek attacked us? The Pasuk writes, Asher Karecha. The word Karecha means that Amalek came with a philosophy. And they came and told the Jewish people, you believe in God? It's a mistake. Amalek were atheists. They came, Asher Karecha. They told the Jewish people, everything is mikre. Everything is random. There's no God in the world. Life is all happenstance. Life is all, it's just a bunch of events that just happen. But there's no justice in this world. And there's no formula in this world. Amalek's of the opinion that when the sea split for the Jewish people, it just happened. There was no design over there that there was a God that came. It happened to be good luck. That they happened to come at the water at that moment and the easterly wind came and split it for them. Oh, and the 10 plagues. Fluke. Happened to be that they all came down at the night. Lucky, we're not saying no. It happens, by the way. Guy goes to the casino, sometimes he wins the 10 shots in a row. It can happen. It's odds. Guy wins a lot of 1 in a billion. It happens. That's Amalek. But there's nothing. There's no God. There's nobody controlling it. Everything is just an event that's isolated and it's all chance and it's all mikre. So when they came to fight the Jewish people, it was an ideological war. They weren't only coming with guns. They came with books, they came with pamphlets, they were dropping pamphlets all over the people. The paraphernalia, propaganda. The Jews picked up the thing, there is no God. There is no control, there is no hashkaha, there is no divine providence. They were coming and trying to poison the minds of the Jewish people to say everything is just happens by itself. There's no control over the world. Haman, who's a grandson of Amalek, he was loyal to this philosophy. You remember when it came to killing the Jewish people, what method did he use to figure out the date? A lotto. He put all the tickets in the thing, he shook them up, and this day over here. There's nothing more indicative of just luck than a lotto. But that's the way they believe. They believe everything in life. A guy walks down the street, one guy trips, one guy doesn't. That's just the way it worked out. Nature came and shook up all the names, threw them out on the table. Some guys became rich, some guys became poor, some guys die young, some guys live old, some guys get sick, some guys... It just... That's their philosophy. Do we believe in this philosophy? Certainly not. But does their philosophy make a little sense, maybe? Or can you slip into believing that a little? I think so. Look at the world we live in. Can anybody make sense of the world? Could anybody give me a formula that if you follow the formula, you can know the results? Give me a formula. If you go to shul every day and you're religious, you'll become wealthy and live forever. And you won't have a problem in the world. It's not true. I'll show you that religious people suffer. I'll show you righteous people have a difficult life. I'll show you people that work on Shabbat and eat taref are rolling. They're living the life of Riley. They're living like kings. Could you understand this life? Could you tell me why there's children in the hospital sick? Could you tell me why does an Arab have strength over a Jew to homicide him? Explain me this. You look at the world the way it is, and it looks very random. It looks like things just happen. You can't. Could you give me an equation? If this is done, then this will happen. It just happens. Sometimes the righteous get hit. Sometimes the Rishaim. There's no rhyme or reason. When you look at the world, you say, "What's going on over here?" Well, you're going to tell me every person that closed the store on Shabbat became wealthy? I'll show you people that closed their store on Shabbat, their stores burnt down. Finished. They lost all their money. What are you going to tell me? Could there be God? It's random. This thing just happens. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's the craps. You roll it. Of course we don't believe this. But there's definitely... Why did he get married at 18 and he got married at 33? Why does it happen? Not fair. So you tell it's random. He says, it's God picking a big, not God. So whoever it is, Mother Nature, as we call it, just picks names out of the hat. You this way, you that way. There's no control. The shooing of the bird negates this whole philosophy. Because if you think about it, what's the logic to shoo away the mother bird? Say compassion. What, you're going to steal the children in front of the mother? The hazita, the mother, you don't want to do that to the mother. So the Torah says, take the mother, shoo it away. Now she doesn't know what's going on, you take the children. Not to pain the mother. So the Torah is having compassion seemingly on the mother bird. But you might ask yourself, only on this animal you have compassion? What about every other animal? Why is God only good to this animal? Why is only God good to the mother bird? What about the mother girl, the mother goose? What about the mother duck? What about the mother ox? Only this one? So when you come to Shiluah HaKen, you start questioning, well, it doesn't make sense, this mitzvah. Why is God's compassion only... So what do you come to the conclusion? That everything's chance again. So, you know, again, they did their old dice. Who won? The bird won. There's no rhyme or reason. Ki yikare... The mitzvah is only fulfilled if it happens by chance. Because the mitzvah of Shiluah HaKen is trying to teach you that things that seemingly look like chance, that just happening, it's really God behind it. And therefore, one that fulfills this mitzvah is really saying, I don't know why God chose this bird to give compassion to and not any other animal. But it's God. So therefore, when one fulfills this mitzvah, it's not the mere action that he's getting rewarded for. He's buying into a philosophy. He's buying into an ideology. The asher karecha of Amalek, which is everything is mekreh. Ki yekarek hansipor. When this happenstance happened, when you just walk down the street and it appears in front of you, you say, oh, chance, not a little chance. And you do the mitzvah, and you decide to have compassion on this, and you don't ask, why is this not that? Your answer is obviously God knows what he's doing. So fulfilling this mitzvah is actually a testimony that there's God in the world, and he controls, and whether we understand it or not, one day it'll become evident. Now you tell me, is it not worthy to get rewarded for such a mitzvah? This deserves the greatest sakhar ever. Look what he's testifying to. This thing with the birds is one of the greatest acts that a person can do. To come and give testimony that God is in control and there's no mistakes and there's justice and he's right. And whether we have an answer now or later, but it's correct. And that's what David HaMelech says in Tehillim. David HaMelech says, Ish bar lo yada. Uksil lo yavin et zot. Says the imbecile and the fool doesn't understand this. What doesn't he understand? Befrowach resha'im kemo eseb vayasisu kol po'ale avet. The imbecile cannot understand why did this resha'im, why do they flourish like grass? Why are the evil people so successful? Why do people that commit all sorts of sins, they do everything wrong, and look what Borei Olam does to them. He gives them the greatest success. So David HaMelech says, the idiot, the fool doesn't understand this. So I have a question on David HaMelech. Well, and the Hakam does understand it. You shamble the guy. Oh, the fool, the idiot. He's barlo yeda. David HaMelech calls the guy all sorts of names. All right, show me somebody in the world that does understand it. David. Does Hakam understand it? So why is David calling such names? And the explanation is like this. In the Haggadah Shel Pesach, we have four sons. The Hakam, the Rasha, the Tam, the Shein Odei, and the Shal. The Hakam, okay, we know he's a Hakam. He asks, what is this? What is that? He wants to understand. The Rasha is a sarcastic guy. The kid that doesn't know how to ask, okay, Hazit Miskin. I want to talk about the Tam. The Tam is a simple guy. Now, simple is a negative terminology. You don't want your children to be simple. What makes the Tam Tam? Well, let's see his question. His question is to his father on Eid Pesach, Mazot. What's this? Hazit, it's a good question. Does anybody understand the Seder? The Seder is a complicated item. So the kid comes to his father, Daddy, Mazot. Oh, you're a Tam. What Tam? I'm asking a question. That's how you answer. I'm a Tam. The explanation is like this. You know why he's a Tam? Because on the night of the Seder, we do 1,000 different things. And what does this kid ask? Mazot. What's this? Well, everything else you understand? One item. What's this? Fool. Be the Hakam. The Hakam is very honest. Hakam says, I don't understand anything. Maha'edut, okay, Mishpatim. Explain me the whole story. When a person comes along and says, what's this? He's a fool. He's giving an impression that everything else he has an understanding to. It's like a fellow that once went to NASA, the space center in Houston, and they gave him a tour of Houston. They showed him the room where they controlled the space shuttle from hundreds of thousands of miles away. The toggles, the switches, the communication. Then they took him to another room where they make the shuttle. And he's watching for hours, exactly the tour, exactly what they're showing him. They show him all the components, the fiberglass, the screws, the bolts, the nuts. After 2 hours, He turns to the two of us and can I ask you one question? What do they use this screw for? The guy says, to pish. Yeah, everything else till now you understood, Yanni. We saw the most massive operation. But until you got to the screw, now already you're all jammed up. Now you can't understand it? Whatever. The guy mazot. Everything else you understood? And the screw is what disoriented you? So even though he's asking a question, but you're a fool. David HaMelech says, Ish ba'ar lo yeda, uksir lo yavin et zot. You know why he's a fool? Because that's the only question he has on God. Why do the wicked people prosper? That's a good question. But if you're asking 1,000 questions, okay. But that's the only guy's question. This I don't understand. Ish ba'ar lo yeda, uksir lo yavin et zot. Etzot, you're a fool. Everything else you understand? You understand how the trees work? You understand how the stomach works? You understand how oxygen works? Well, you understand how a plane flies? You understand how a fax... Yeah, all the miracles that you see. That's your good. One question, you're tipish. And that's exactly what Shiloh HaKen comes along and says. The mitzvah of Shiloh HaKen is to come and tell the person that happenstance and randomness is by design. It's from Borei Olam. It's not like Amalek says, Ki yikarek asher karecha. Ki yikarek an sipor. Comes and shows that there is justice. And why is God merciful to this bird and not to that bird? It's not favoritism. There's a reason for it. And one day it'll be understood. So let's review quickly. Tonight we learned 3 or 4 important lessons. Number one, we received a novel interpretation on the Eshet Yifat Tu'ar with the redeeming of the souls that are into captivity. Number two, we discussed 4 lessons in parenting from the Ben Sorer Umoreh. And lastly, we understood that the Kan Sipor is not merely an act. It's more subscribing to a philosophy, and that's why it's deserving of the rewards that the Torah showers us with. Baruch Adonai le'olam. Amen ve'amen. Rabbi Hananya ben Akashia omer, Asak alos barachot zekot Yisrael, Lefikha kerbal atasu shre'emar, Adonai hafes l'man tzidko yagdir Torah ve'yadir.
Kedah v'kedah shomer haba.
Amen.
Adam ha'divar kertev, amnik ma'otev, etzmak bukaneh v'kedah mishukhe. Bukha yechon b'yamachon b'chay lefo b'yit Yisrael b'agla v'zman karib v'mu amen. Yehe shomer haba m'barach l'alam l'omeh. ישפוט שבת וכבר בזמן מנסה מדבר ודבר וכבר שמלך ישראל ביקו לילה מכל ברצה שרצה תשפחה ונחמצה זה אמרה במלאב אמן אל ישראל ואל תנאי ואל תנאי ואל כל כמידי כמידון ועסקים ברצה קדישה דין בעצה דין בכל אתר ועצה יהי לנו לכל נוכן החסדר החמד כדי מאמר שם בו אמן ובכל שמר הבא מי שמע חיים וסבא ושואה ונחמה ושפורה ופורה וגלה וסבכה חרה ילה פרסלן לכל מושב ומואמן עשה שלום ברמה ורחמה ועשה שלום לכל מושב ומואמן